Now to our distinguished panel for their comments. Our first panelist is Thomas Graff, who I mentioned before, a senior attorney at the Environmental Defense Fund. He founded the EDF California office in 1971. He currently directs the fund's program on transportation and has been an active leader in the areas of air pollution and water conservation and energy policy. He's a member of the Governor's Commission on Transportation Investment, as well as the Bay Advisory Committee. He received his master's degree from the London School of Economics and his JD also from Harvard Law School. Thomas held faculty positions at Bolt School of Law at UC Berkeley and at Harvard Law School. Tom Graff.
This is the first Groundhog Day of the new millennium. Some of the distinctions that are made in both books lead me to wonder on which side of the divide I and my organization fall. The one that Peter just mentioned, soft versus hard, a government, pro-government perspective, a pro-private sector perspective, a coercive command and control approach to environmental policy, an approach that emphasizes incentives, large-scale solutions versus small-scale solutions, a pessimistic point of view versus an optimistic one. And I would, for myself, pretty much come down on the right-hand column, but I believe that the prior speakers, perhaps at least, would come to the conclusion that no, that isn't right, that I'm a soft green, I guess, and a pro-government green, and a pro-coercion green, and so on. I think, in a way, Peter got it right in saying that most of the issues that matter involve both private incentives and some form of government intervention, even if it's just calling on the courts in the last resort. Turns out the issues that I've worked on most intensively involve government in a much more comprehensive way. Several were mentioned. By the way, there's a little interview that was done of me that you might be interested in that deals particularly with water and transportation issues in the state at the moment. But water issues have pervasively been, particularly in the West, have been dominated by government intervention, by government subsidy. Similarly, the highways were mentioned. Highways are, with few exceptions, have been entirely a public domain. And even electricity, which is, at least at the generation level, shifting now towards a more private-oriented approach, has been primarily in a regulated by public utility commissions around the country. In some cases, even large publicly owned utilities have been the dominant paradigm. Given that, naturally, we fall in a category of supporters of moving towards incentive-oriented approaches, of user fee approaches. One of the things I would ask Peter to take another look at in his book, he has a very short piece in which he disparages pollution taxes and by implication perhaps user fees. I think that's short-sighted. Perhaps any tax is a bad tax. That could be true. But it also is the case that if we use taxes that are counterproductive, as for example we're doing in California, increasingly using sales taxes to subsidize road construction, we will get it exactly backwards. So I think we really ought to look hard at tax policy and indeed do what he sort of suggests probably is a good idea, but maybe is a subterfuge, namely move towards taxes on consumption rather than taxes on income and on labor. Just as an aside, a colleague of mine, I was in the state legislature yesterday, and a colleague of mine was being quizzed by a group of legislators, and he made the statement that he preferred to pay for his food at the grocery store rather than in income taxes. And boy, was he jumped on by the legislative committee members, all Democrats in this case, by the way, for making such a statement. Yet, the fact of the matter is that we use water policy in California and around the nation to allegedly for a cheap food policy, and in fact, in the, as a result, do inestimable damage to aquatic resources, which, if water were priced properly, would be relatively protected. So those are just a few of the points. It's a complex world, yes. Private sector approaches, ITQs in the fisheries area, for example, are good things. It is incumbent upon those of us who work for soft organizations to work with those who have conservative political perspectives and bring those political forces together to make change. But we oughtn't to be too simplistic. We ought to recognize, as I think the speakers actually do, that government is indeed inevitable, and the point is to make it work and to use market-oriented incentives and the like as best we can to ameliorate what often is a best klutzy approach to public policy.
Our next speaker is Sally Fairfax. She is a co-author of two books, The Federal Lands and State Trust Lands, and her articles, many articles, have appeared in such journals as the Ecology Lore Quarterly, Natural Resources Journal, and elsewhere. I'm pleased to introduce Sally Fairfax.
I'm a political scientist, which is sort of the epicenter of irrelevance. But I want to add the feeble voice of my profession to the discussions that we've heard this evening, which have tended over time in the direction of complexity. Instead of saying, well, which is better, the market or the government, I'd like to advocate a very simple approach to that complexity, which is cycles, and say that at certain times in our history, privatization or private markets have seemed more attractive than government intervention, and at certain other times, government intervention has seemed more attractive than markets. And I think this is sort of the way it's going. I think that maybe it's not appropriate or necessary, but it's certainly the way things have been. I'd like to apply that brilliant insight to the area that I do know something about, which is public lands and resources. And it's probably less well known than it ought to be that between the 1850s and the turn of the last century, almost all conservation was private. Joe Sachs has written a really interesting book about the role of private property in conservation, for those of you that are interested, called something like Throwing Darts at a Rembrandt or Playing Darts. It's a very interesting book on the sort of the balances of publicness and privateness in property, which is, I think, what Peter was trying to get at when he was talking about not wanting to privatize the Grand Canyon, for example, or at least have that not a fruitful debate. But Mount Vernon, which Michael mentioned, Fort Ticonderoga, the Alamo, are all good examples of private conservation efforts. I'm fond of pointing to the Mount Vernon Ladies Association. Everybody wants to say that's the Sierra Club or some other organization, the Trust for Reservations in New Massachusetts are the first major conservation efforts. I think it's important to notice that the first major conservation group, the first national fundraising effort, and so on for conservation was in fact a ladies association, which is very typical of the whole conservation movement. Gifford Pinchot and his sort of testosterone poisoning approach, to the contrary, notwithstanding. What's less well understood, of course, is I think that most of the early conservation of the Gettysburg battlefields was also private. And I could go into a long shtick on that because I'm about to put a book out on that subject, but it's a very interesting process by which the government got its hands involved in battlefield preservation. It's worth noting as well that this emphasis on private conservation was put aside for a number of reasons. One, I think, was that it just wasn't enough. And I think another reason was that the notion of private property was not understood as the way it is today, and it led to a lot of dismay at the excesses of privatization. And so we were sort of eliding at that time away from what one might consider a Lockean notion of property to a a more social notion, which was more appropriate and supportive of the agenda of the progressive movement. I think it's worth noting, however, that the idea of private conservation and private management of public resources, indeed, was not completely rejected. And we have sold ourselves a whole passel of misunderstandings and misdirections when we say that we gave up privatization and went into a big era of government retention, government ownership, and government management of land. The figure, one-third our nation's land, or the government owns and manages about a third of, or whatever, however that comes up, is a very bad number. And I'll just talk about that for a minute or two, and then I'll sit down, and hopefully we can all get to dinner. But the point that I would like to make is that the green blob that you find on the AAA map is a very bad way to understand the nature and extent of federal ownership. And it's important that we not misunderstand what the government retained and what it owns and what it manages, and mislead ourselves into misunderstanding what the government ought to be held accountable for. I am not going to make a huge brief for the brilliance of the National Park Service. As a person who has a degree in forestry, I would never defend the Park Service anywhere. And besides that, I happen to think that they are probably the most feckless and witless long-term federal agency. But that's just my biased little opinion because, as I said, I was trained as a forester. But the point that I want to make is that federally retained land is not clearly federally retained. Different parts of what we now call the bundle of sticks were held in different contexts under different circumstances regarding different political different resources. And one of the most extensive kinds of federal ownership is what we have come to call in my lab at school nominal federal retention. That is to say, the federal government holds nominal title and the control is effectively private. And the best example of that, I think you can make a very compelling case with a slightly different fact situation for both the BLM-managed public range and the Forest Service managed public range. And if anybody wants to hear that, you know, that's another book, so, you know, we could go on. Elsewhere, the federal government has retained title and control, but not the financial benefits. And a good example of that is most energy and construction grade minerals. So it's not clear to me what you're looking at when you look at government ownership and management of land. How much of that is actually government and how much of that is actually private, I think is a matter that's at least worth exploring before we draw a whole lot of conclusions about government ownership of land. I also don't think that it's prudent to go back and look at the days of Teddy Roosevelt and characterize this as some kind of a palmy day of government science operating on the land. I don't think anybody, I mean, is there anybody else here who has the, well, I may be the only one that's both a political scientist and a forester, but are there any foresters here? Well, you don't have to be in forestry school for very long to understand that what is being palmed off as a science is nothing more than an economic model. Forest management, as it was imported into this country by Gifford Pinchot and a series of previous German-trained foresters, is not a scientific model, it's an economic model. And it has to do with a model of a state like Germany, which thought itself to be land poor, tree poor, and in a situation in which trees were absolutely mandatory for their economic survival. And it was in response to those sort of economic and cultural pressures that the idea of cut equals growth and the regulated forest emerged. And there was some understanding of the physiology of trees that went into it, but the basic idea was to maintain the stock in perpetuity. And it made sense in that particular time and place in Germany. It made absolutely no sense in an area where land wasn't scarce, trees weren't scarce, labor was expensive, and there's no conceivable basis under which it's possible to characterize German forestry as applied science. It just doesn't make any sense. A good example of that, we could talk about the fire policy that this led people to adopt It was not, by the way, the epicenter of government forestry. It was what was forced on the government by a number of entrepreneurial advocates who alleged that they, who are now being alleged to be better managers, who simply said they couldn't afford to invest when it burns. I could go on. I probably shouldn't. I'm as hungry as you are, but I guess and I have one of those, you know, sugar things, you know, where I get really pissy if I don't eat. So I will just conclude by saying that one of the articles that I'm working on now with one of my colleagues, who is in fact a marine biologist and I'm clearly not, is that it seems to me that what is proposed, you know, for the oceans in terms of ITQs and stuff, ought to be examined before we argue that it's a great idea through the lens of what we've done to the public range. Appallingly similar impulses underlie it, and I would want to look at it a little bit more closely, not only with a marine biologist but with a range con before I jumped into that ship.
So. Thank you, Sally. So, Michael, do you want to add any comments?
Sure, quickly.
Sure.
I'll just since Peter brought back the practicality of selling off the Grand Canyon or what to do with the Grand Canyon, I merely raised that issue because since I'd done a fair amount of slagging government, the government conservation of state, I thought I'd mention that I didn't think we should sell that off, and I really meant it. I'm interested in what's practical as well, and my point in a lot of what I brought up was in looking at the legal hindrances that have been created to private conservation activities. You know, is most of Arizona, I think, is enough. You know, stop, give someone else a chance. And in a lot of cases, just private conservation just hasn't been possible. One of the things we put on our little, logo of the Center for Private Conservation, we put the head of a wood duck. Not to say that the wood duck was completely saved by private conservation. It wasn't. It was saved on public lands, too. But a lot of what had to do with saving the wood duck was the actions of private individuals, clubs, groups, you know, Boy Scouts, whatever, who would go and knock on people's door and say, look, we've got a wood duck box. It'll attract these wood ducks. They've been in decline. Can we put this on your land? And people would say, yeah, that sounds great. I'd love to have wood ducks there. And now we have an Endangered Species Act that if wood ducks were endangered, nobody would want wood ducks on their land. And I think we really need to consider the sort of the implications of in a lot of cases, how to change the legal system to make private conservation possible. The reason that there's been such fantastic success in Zimbabwe with these private conservancies was a change in the law some years ago that said, okay, the state still retains ownership of all the wildlife, but it gave private landowners the ability to manage that wildlife. And suddenly they could get a return from wildlife. And that's why all sorts of people throughout Zimbabwe are switching from ranching and farming to producing wildlife. Before they couldn't. Now they can, if there are more antelope on their property, then a few of them can get hunted and they'll get a great return. Oh, sorry. Sure. I'm almost done. But there's a similar example in Texas where the game in Texas is the sort of the king's game model. And so there are a whole bunch of ranchers in Texas who are members of a thing called the Texas Exotic Wildlife Association, and they've imported exotic animals from places like Africa. And because they can actually own those species, have really promulgated them. I think scimitar horned oryx, something like that. There's more of them in Texas than in southern Africa where they came from. And so I'm not saying there's no place for a conservationist state or for government to get involved in conservation. I'm just saying let's be practical and let's sort of tap into this ingenuity of private conservation that's out there.
Peter, any further comments?